Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the next episode of the Disclosure Podcast. I hope that you're well, and I hope that you're safe, and I hope that you're looking after yourselves and practicing maybe some of the self-care things that we spoke about in the last episode, making sure that you're taking time to enjoy yourself, you know, doing things that you enjoy, maybe finding new hobbies, and also maybe learning about different ways to be an advocate for veganism, maybe starting that Instagram account, wherever that's a positive one, or like a vegan one, which is also positive as well, but one solely focused on vegan activism, or one solely focused on kind of like things you enjoy outside of veganism. I hope you've been able to enjoy yourself, and you've not been able to, or you've been able to distract yourself from the outside world, which at times right now especially feels like a very negative place, doesn't it? This week's episode is kind of going to be going through some news that's come out in the past week or so. Things I think that might be interesting for us to discuss related to what's going on with the pandemic. Before we do that, just a quick thank you to all my patrons. Thank you to all of you who support my work from my website. I appreciate it very much. If you would like more Disclosure Podcast episodes, then I do a monthly Q&A through my Patreon for my patron supporters, where I answer any questions they have for me. So if that sounds like something you'd be interested in, then you can get access to that through my Patreon. And also, just another thing that I like to say at the beginning is, if you enjoy the podcast, then please do leave a review. It means the world to me, and it really helps building the profile of the podcast. In fact, I've seen that some of you guys have been leaving me some reviews in the past few weeks. So thank you so much for those lovely, lovely reviews and the feedback. And thank you for listening. Thank you to all of you for listening to the podcasts, whether this is your first one or your 12th one, whatever it might be. Thank you so much for starting to listen to this podcast. I really hope that you enjoy them, and I also hope that you enjoy this episode as well. Right, so I think it's important for us to talk about kind of what's happening at the moment, because there's so much happening right now, isn't there? And it's just constant stream of new information regarding the pandemic, and I guess all the different intricacies of these zoonotic diseases. Now, I spoke, was it last week or 2 weeks ago, we were talking very much about the relationship between animal exploitation and zoonotic diseases. And we talked about the Instagram post where I'd put that COVID-19 would not have started if the world was vegan, right? Basically saying that, you know, and a whole host of different zoonotic diseases only occur because we exploit animals. Now, the USA Today did like a debunking fact check on that Instagram post. And then they censored the post because they said it was partly false, basically saying that the information there wasn't wholly true because, well, I mean, some zoonotic diseases would happen even if the world was vegan. And also that we couldn't rule out the chance that humans would make contact with a pangolin who'd, you know, been passed the virus on, or been passed the virus to from a bat, which is the chain of the disease that it is what we think is most plausible as it stands. Of course, things can change, but as it stands, the main thinking is that it's gone from bat to pangolin to human, facilitated, of course, through the wet market in Wuhan. And so using that information, that's what I made the post about. And so it was censored as being partly false by the USA Today. And I wrote a response for Plant-Based News, basically outlining my the reasons why I felt that the fact check that the USA Today had done on my post was disingenuous and not in reference to what the points I was making actually were, which is that, basically to summarize, I'd never said that zoonotic diseases were solely caused by exploitation of animals, only that significant numbers of them are directly correlated to. And if we didn't exploit animals, significant numbers of them probably wouldn't exist, because the only reason they've ever come to exist is because we exploit animals. And the second thing that often annoyed me about the discourse around the conversation around veganism and zoonotic disease is people seem to think that we're making the claim that you have to physically consume the animal to get the zoonotic disease. Now, that's true for some, mainly bacterial, bacterial diseases, things like salmonella, trichinellosis, different ones like that, which are from physical consumption. But the vast majority of these diseases that we're talking about, especially, of course, the viruses, are more about contact and proximity rather than physical consumption. And yet that point often gets ignored, or has been ignored, especially I felt in these the USA Today article, and a lot of the discourse around what we as vegans have been saying, is to say, well, actually, it's not to do with eating bat soup. And it's like, well, no, never claimed it was. But of course, it's to do with proximity to animals and markets, slaughterhouses, farms. What they do is ramp up the proximity of different species of animals and humans. And of course, you know, wild animals can come into contact with domesticated farm animals, but not even that, because that doesn't even need to happen, because domesticated farm animals, you know, poultry and pigs, so chickens, but also ducks, quail, which is something we'll talk about later, and also humans, they're all absolutely, those three species were all able to pass, or types of species were all able to pass flu type viruses between each other, and that constant crossing over can cause mutations, and so that's a big problem. And so it doesn't even need to be about wild animals, just farming in and of itself can create these environments, because we farm animals that are known for creating, well, or for passing on flu type viruses. So they did that fact check, and that about a week passed or so, and then something interesting happened. So the Guardian released an article, and I kind of wanted to discuss this article. I shared it on my Instagram and also on my Facebook, so you may have seen it already. But the Guardian came out, I think it was the 28th of March this article came out, and the article, the headline is factory farming to blame for coronavirus? Now, when I saw that, I was like, great, there's a good conversation starting here. So I'm not going to read out the whole thing. There's one thing at the end that I particularly wanted to draw. In fact, let's start there. Let's start there, because this is what I'm most interested in talking about. But there were some other snippets in there, which I found very interesting as well. Anyway, so I was reading through this article completely just like, yeah, this is good. And at the end, third to last paragraph, the journalist Laura, she says this. Where has it gone? There have been claims on social media, sometimes posted by vegans, that if we ate less meat, there would have been no COVID-19. Interestingly, some of these have been blocked by mainstream news organizations as partly false. And actually there she creates a link, and the link goes to the USA Today article about my Instagram post. This is great. So she says, interestingly, some of these have been blocked by mainstream news organizations as partly false, but the claims are also partly true. Though the links they draw are too simplistic, the evidence is now strong that the way meat is produced, and not just in China, contributed to COVID-19. That's great. Okay, that to me shows a real great progression in the conversation, right? And what annoyed me about that partly false verdict by USA Today was that it also means that the claims are also partly true. And I'd replied to the journalist who had wrote the USA Today article saying, I don't understand, why is it that we say partly false and not partly true? Why is the prerogative to take the negative, to create a negative impression, when actually the information is also partly true? And if the information is partly true by your own admission, even though that admission is somewhat implicit rather than explicit, even though that is an implicit acknowledgement, to then censor a post, even though you recognize that the information in the post is at least partly true, it is nonsensical and surely dangerous. And I'm really glad that it said this in the Guardian article, but the claims are also partly true. Absolutely. Well, they're not partly true, are they? Another thing is, obviously, it says that if we ate less meat, I mean, no, if we ate no meat or didn't exploit animals in the first place is really the point, because it's not just about consumption of meat, and reducing consumption of meat doesn't eliminate the problem. Sure, it could reduce the problem because you're reducing the meat, but if we were to eliminate animal exploitation, that's the best way to eliminate the chance of many forms of zoonotic disease, right? Though the links they draw are too simplistic. You know, I read that and I kind of had to roll my eyes a little bit. It's like, okay, well, of course you had to put something in there. I mean, I get that, I'm sure. You know, it couldn't just wholly agree with me. And is it too simplistic, though? I mean, I don't see how it's too simplistic. I did think about this, too simplistic. What does that mean? And I can't really work out what that means. I don't think the idea of stopping something at the root cause of how that something began, I don't understand that as being simplistic. I see it as being kind of like, let's say, lung cancer. You know, you smoke cigarettes your entire life and you get lung cancer at the end. And the doctor says, well, you have lung cancer because you smoke cigarettes. Now, this is like the USA Today thinking. Now, I could turn around to that doctor and say, I mean, yes, of course, smoking does increase the risk of lung cancer, but there's no way of knowing whether or not I'd have got lung cancer even if I didn't smoke. I could have still got lung cancer if I didn't smoke. And the doctor goes, well, of course, you could have still got lung cancer, but you can't deny that if you've not smoked your entire life, the risk, you know, dramatically diminished, which is, I guess, this is the argument we're making here, right? It's like, yes, of course, these things can still happen, but if you eliminate the main reason why these things are happening, then of course the logical, you know, the logic would then presume that you're dramatically reducing the chance of this happening. And so I don't think it's simplistic. It'd be like saying, if you didn't smoke, you'd reduce your risk of lung cancer, and then going, oh, that's a bit simplistic. It's like, well, it is simple, but it doesn't mean that the argument itself is flawed just because it's simplistic. The reality is simplistic. Stop A to reduce B. So stop smoking to reduce lung cancer, or alternatively, in terms of what we're actually discussing, stop exploiting animals to reduce zoonotic disease. Of course, we're never going to eliminate all lung cancer, right? Okay. But that doesn't mean smoking shouldn't be correlated with lung cancer in the same way that we're never going to eliminate all zoonotic disease. But that doesn't mean that zoonotic diseases, or, you know, in many of them shouldn't be correlated with exploiting animals. So I thought simplistic. I thought, well, it is simple. That's not a negative. That's a good thing. I mean, it's great when problems have simple solutions. Isn't that what we want? Rather than going, gosh, if only there was a really complex way to fix this. It's like, well, no, I mean, it is simplistic, but it's a simple fix that can help. Again, not going to change everything, not going to stop all of them, but simplistic, absolutely. The evidence is now strong that the way meat is produced, and not just in China, that was so positive for me to see. Absolutely, this is something that we've been banging the drum about. It's not just China. Yes, of course, there are certain ways that, you know, the Chinese animal trade operates, especially with live animals and wild animals, that absolutely increases the chance of these happening. And sometimes very pernicious diseases found in wild animal hosts. But it's not just in China, contributed to COVID-19. I thought that was good. So I was very happy to see that, because it felt like a lot of the conversation had been, no, this is almost conspiratorial, you know, like a conspiracy. That's how it felt for so long. And so to kind of get that was, I mean, from a personal perspective, validating, but on a broader perspective was also really optimistic to see in terms of the conversation. Now, anyway, there's a couple of bits in this piece that I just wanted to draw your guys' attention to. This is actually an interesting point. I'm just, because I don't want to flip too much in between different sections, but this is an interesting point. Because the actual article itself is about factory farming, but this is, I found this to be particularly interesting. The article states, not everybody sees a straightforward link between factory farming and new and dangerous forms of flu. Michael Warabe, potentially wrong pronunciation, Michael Warabe, an evolutionary biologist at the University of Arizona, points out that before they were brought into factory farms, poultry were kept outside. The factory model may ramp up the virulence, he says, but it probably protects a flock from being infected by a virus in the first place. Now, this is interesting, isn't it? Because obviously we're thinking about factory farming, we're thinking about animals being in very cramped, closed inside conditions. Now, one of the big problems with places like Asia, with the booming industrialization of farming, is that alongside the actual farming, you do have tropical animals, and tropical animals, particularly wild animals in say Africa and Asia, are the ones who are most notorious for spreading certain forms of zoonotic disease. And so a problem you have with industrialized agriculture, also in areas where you have these wild animals who are known reservoirs for some of the worst zoonotic disease we've encountered, those being, let's say, Ebola, you know, Marburg, for examples like that, you create this very dangerous thing where you have wild animals in contact with domesticated farm animals, both of which are notorious for spreading zoonotic disease. But if these animals are raised outside, they have more chance of coming into contact with the wild animals, say the bats flying overhead, or the bats defecating, or the bats eating and leftover food being left that's then consumed by pigs or chickens. And then you have the really significant worries. Now, this is by no means an argument for factory farming, but it's an argument against outdoor farming, because outdoor farming increases the risk in a different way. Indoor factory farming increases the risk in terms of like this really totalitarian spread of a virus or of a disease through this, the intensely overcrowded conditions, of course, just a perfect environment for disease to thrive. But even if we were to create more small scale outdoor reared systems, the risk is still very much around for a different reason, potentially. I thought that was quite interesting. But there was something here about the origins of flu to begin with. So this is another part in the article. It says here, take flu, a disease that is considered to have high pandemic potential, having caused an estimated 15 pandemics in the past 500 years. There is a clear link between the emergence of highly pathogenic avian influenza viruses and intensified poultry production systems. The reasons, many of which were documented in a book called Big Farms Make Big Flu, include the density with which chickens, turkeys, or other poultry are packed into factory farms, and the fact that the birds in a given farm tend to be near genetic clones of one another, having been selected over decades for desirable traits, such as lean meat. If a virus gets introduced into such a flock, it can race through it without meeting any resistance in the form of genetic variants that prevent its spread. Both experimental manipulations and observations in the real world have demonstrated this process can result in the ratcheting up of the virus's virulence. If it then spills into humans, we are potentially in trouble, which is exactly what we've seen. And this is interesting here. It's possible, though by no means certain, that flu first became a disease of humans after the Chinese domesticated ducks about 4,000 years ago, drawing that animal reservoir into human communities for the first times. But humans can also catch flu from and give flu to pigs, another animal we have lived alongside for millennia. A few years ago, Warraby suggested controversially that birds might not always have been the main immediate host for human flu viruses. Until about a century ago, he reported that many people also caught flu from horses. Around the time that motor vehicles supplanted horses as transport, poultry farmers expanding in the Western Hemisphere. And it's possible, Warraby argued, that birds then took over as the main intermediate host of flu for animals. So that's interesting. We've not really talked much about horses. I mean, MERS, which is a coronavirus, came from camels. I think it went from bat to camel to human. And so that's interesting. But of course, our close connection with horses was due to the fact that we exploited them for transport. So again, there's clear links there. But this is, I've heard this many times before, that the origins of flu are deeply associated with our domestication of animals when we began domesticating them. And it was through domesticating poultry and other farm animals, pigs, that we began then to really introduce flu into the human population. And that many of these flus and influenzas potentially didn't even exist in human populations before we started domesticating animals through a form of exploitation to consume them, which is a very interesting thing. If we move past that Guardian article now, but I do think there's very interesting ideas and interesting discussion in there, and I think just from a personal perspective, it was nice to see the post I'd done referenced and also claimed as being partly true, even though, of course, I would still stand by it being wholly true, or at least, you know, if we look into probability, of course, it's absolutely tiny that it could have happened, although it wouldn't have happened like it has done now, because it only happened now because of what we did to animals. This is why I also get a bit confused when people who say, well, it's not to do with eating meat, they say, well, it could happen anyway. And it's like, well, it wouldn't have happened now, though, would it? There's 0% chance that this would be happening right now in the way that it is if it wasn't for what we did. And also, like, if we think about it in terms of densely populated human areas, if it was that we had to go into the wild to get these animals, then the chance of it spreading would be so significantly reduced, because the thing is, we contract or we get the virus in a densely populated city like Wuhan, and it just spreads instantly because people are just around people instantly. But if we're relying on just getting these diseases from encountering wild animals in the wild, then by the fact that you're in the wild means that you're not in densely human populated areas, which would dramatically reduce the spread anyway. So even if we did create, or even if we did come into contact with animals and get the same zoonotic disease, the chance of it spreading to a pandemic level would be dramatically decreased, because it would happen, or it'd be transmitted to humans in an area that wasn't densely populated by humans to begin with, hence why the wild animals are there in the first place. It's kind of like when we think about, I guess, like Ebola, or like diseases that come from, you know, bushmeat exploitation, and why they're probably not as much of a worry for a pandemic, because of the socio, you know, economic and geographical locations, the geopolitical climate of where these diseases are contracted, you know, poorer places in Africa. But because of that, because it's reliant on the consumption of bushmeat, the chance for ever spreading in a global pandemic way is dramatically reduced, because by the virtue of these people hunting bushmeat to survive, it suggests they don't live in a very built-up urbanized area to begin with, because if they were, they wouldn't be hunting bushmeat to survive. And so even in those situations, the risk of the pandemic is dramatically reduced. And so again, if it was just reliant on the contact with wild animals, it would be such a small chance of it happening, almost impossible, to the point where you should say that the Instagram post is wholly true. Anyway, let's move on, because I found a whole bunch of articles recently. In fact, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 in front of me right now that I think are interesting to read through. So this is all happening while we're talking about the COVID-19 pandemic. Well, whilst that's happening, I came across something interesting. February 11th, 2020, this article was published in Poultry World. First of all, what an absolutely abysmal website, Poultry World. Anyway, get past that point. The headline says, "Bird flu found in western part of Germany." On a backyard farm in the western part of Germany, the Baden-Württemberg province, they found a highly pathogenic H5N8 bird flu. The virus was reported in a town between Stuttgart and Frankfurt, relatively close to the French and Belgian border. The damage is small, only 69 birds, or, I mean, small, isn't it? Again, poultry world, but no, it's not. Damage is not small, it's 69 lives have been taken. 44 died directly of the virus, and the rest were destroyed. I always see this word when we talk about culling of animals, destroyed. Such a horrible word. Murdered really should be the word there. After the official report to the OIE, poultry organizations in the surrounding countries put out notices to increase awareness and a more stringent focus on biosecurity. So that's interesting. So they found bird flu February 11th, highly pathogenic in Western Germany. And you think, okay, that's probably nothing too much to worry about. It's a small backyard chicken facility, not too much to worry about. Okay, so then let's flash forward a month later, March 16th, 2020. So a month after this first one was discovered. Now, this was highly pathogenic H5N8 strain of bird flu. This headline, March 16th, 1 month later, Germany confirms case of H5N8 bird flu in poultry farm. Okay, now this time, this was found in the eastern German state of Saxony. A case of H5N8 bird flu has been confirmed in a poultry farm in the eastern state of Saxony. The Social Affairs and Protection Ministry in the state of Saxony said the case involved a bird flu of type H5N8 found on a farm near Leipzig. All poultry on the farm have been slaughtered. A series of outbreaks of the disease, which in the past has led to major disruptions in slaughtering programs in Europe's poultry industry, have been reported in Europe in the past months. Bird flu cases have appeared in the four central European countries of Slovakia, Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic since the end of last year. So in a period of, what, maybe 5 or 6 months, we've started to see a case of the highly pathogenic H5N8 spreading throughout Central Europe and now into Western Europe as well, into West Germany and East Germany. That's just what we found. Now, this is all while COVID-19 is happening. Now, this is something to bear in mind, of course, scary as it may seem. There's no reason why we couldn't be hit with something else. Yes, of course, the chance of it is low. And as it stands, what we're talking about now isn't a threat to human life necessarily, but these viruses mutate and they could mutate very easily. I mean, it can happen at any point. And what we're aware of right now is that we have these cases of bird flu throughout Europe poultry farms. Now, that could mutate at any point and become a serious problem to human health as well. This is happening right now. But then there's more. This is another article. This was published March 16th. Bird flu is detected in both India and the Philippines, promoting cull of more than 12,000 quails, chickens, and ducks. This was a different strain, H5N6 subtype of the bird flu virus. The Philippines has detected an outbreak of avian flu after tests showed presence of the highly infectious H5N6 subtype of the influenza A virus in a quail farm. So then they've killed 12,000 quails have been killed on this particular farm. And they've also found cases of bird flu in India as well. And another interesting thing that's been happening in India is swine flu. Now, obviously, we had the swine flu pandemic back in 2009. The actual disease, swine flu, does not hold a huge threat to human life. I mean, it killed a lot of people, but also infected huge amounts of people. But what's really troubling about it is the humans didn't have to worry about this type of swine flu. And then back in 1998, the lineage of the virus that we now have within society of swine flu was traced back to a pig farm in North Carolina. Over the next decade, it was mutating. And then, of course, the swine flu pandemic started in 2009, just in a place in Mexico, not far from the US. It became a global pandemic. And now we have swine flu within society because of what we do to animals. And not only that, but it's still killing people. So this was in India. India have been struggling with swine flu, which is a seasonal infection by and large. So in 2017 in India, they had around 40,000 cases and nearly 2,500 deaths. Last year, 2019, they had about just under 30,000 cases and just over 1,200 deaths. And so this is just a problem that's now happening all the time. And not only in India have they got cases of swine flu, but they've also found cases of swine flu in Scotland right now. When was this article published? March 21st this year, 2020. So all this stuff is within the past 6 weeks, but most of it's within the past 4 weeks. Shetland has also just been hit by an outbreak of swine flu, which is just it's just baffling to me. Like, this is just a constant thing. It's constant. I didn't even realize. I just typed in avian flu and swine flu into Google and went through news. And it's just, there's so much all the time. It's never stopping. And all it takes is for one of these viruses to mutate and you have a new zoonotic disease that can cause havoc. And there's no knowing how much of a problem it will be to human society. And so again, to go back to that Guardian article, it's like not just in China. It's like exactly not just in China. Absolutely anywhere. These viruses are popping up all the time. Cases of bird flu, cases of swine flu, different types of the virus, highly pathogenic types of the virus. It's just constant. And it kind of terrifies me to think that, I mean, realistically, this will stop, this current pandemic, and then it goes back to normal almost, right? Just, well, it does. It just goes back to normal. As the human population increases, you know, 2050, we could have 10 billion people. Now, let's say that we are still eating just as much meat as we are now. We now have an extra 2.5 billion people, which means we need to ramp up the amount of meat production or animal product production by another 33% to accommodate a 33% rise in human population in the next 30 years, which is a very short space of time, of course. That only increases the likelihood of these diseases occurring. You create more farms or you optimize farming. I use that word optimizing as an industry term, you know, increasing the number of animals in densely populated areas to feed extra people. Also, what you have to do is you have to encroach into more wildlands. So I think it's very plausible that what we'll see in 30 or 40 years' time is an increase in the prevalence of these outbreaks. There's no other way around it because we're going to have more people. And also remember, more people means more densely populated areas. So more densely populated urban areas, but also more meat production occurring to feed these people, which means more encroachment into wildlands. That's more contact with wild animals who act as reservoirs. But also just more direct contact between wild animals, domesticated animals, and humans. More people to catch the viruses and obviously to spread them. Larger strains on resources, both financial as well as natural, economic and kind of Earth's resources, increasing the volatility of a pandemic, and the volatility in terms of just the likelihood, but also in terms of the devastation becoming more volatile because there's more of us, but there's less resources. This is only going to be a problem that gets worse and worse and worse unless we do something about it. There's no real way around that. And I'm kind of struggling to see what the alternative is here. I feel like we, as a species, we do this thing. It's probably the same with climate change. We talk endlessly about the risk. This is what will happen. This is the risk. And then you go, well, what's the solution? And no one can seem to offer viable solutions properly. I find this all the time with people. It's so easy to complain about problems, isn't it? We all know what these problems are. We all know what the issues are. And so we can talk endlessly about the problems and the systems and the corruption and all these different things that occur. And you go, well, what's the solution? How often do we talk about solutions? There's a thing on Netflix. It's only a short, I know there's like a longer pandemic thing. There's also a short thing as well. It's called like Explained or something, that they're produced by Vox Media, but they do one which is about 20 minutes long on pandemics. It's very scary. It talks about it. It's very informative. It's excellent. It's an informative piece. But when it comes to solutions, there really aren't any. It says that they're trying to, you know, create this type of vaccine that could be used. Because obviously we're always trying to catch up with new viruses. It would basically just work on like a... They explain it and it made sense then. So about creating... Your body would create the antibodies itself rather than having to go through this entire process that we do now. Anyway, that aside, it's this kind of like appeal to science, isn't it? Which as everyday people who aren't involved in that field, it removes accountability from us. And it's almost like, well, you know, science will handle it. I've spoken about before, and I have this feeling about so many issues. I'm like, it's all right, science will handle it. But we do this so often with climate change, and I guess also with zoonotic disease and pandemics in general, is we go, we don't have to worry about it, science will fix it. One day they'll come up with this miracle thing. Basically, it just means we're immune to all influenzas. I mean, would that be lovely? Well, of course it'd be lovely. Is it going to happen though? Well, we just don't know. And when is it going to happen? We just don't know. And so I just think we often talk problems, what are solutions? Okay, we know what the issue is. But there has to be a huge solution right here. Change how we grow food, change how we use natural resources like land, change how we interact with animals, i.e. stop exploiting them and respect wild animals in their wild environments. And then you take huge strides in the right direction to reducing and mitigating these problems. We've talked about this before. There was another thing I saw, it was just a small like blog thing. And they were trying to rebut what I was saying or what vegans were saying. It was about the post, but also broadly about vegans as well. Trying to rebut it by saying, well, not everyone, you know, the world isn't going to go vegan. because some people rely on meat. And I thought, well, what is the point in that line of thinking? You can go, oh, well, you know, the small African tribal village or that kind of like indigenous tribe in the Amazon rainforest, they're not going to go vegan. Okay, but does that mean that we should have industrialized pig and poultry farming or industrialized farming to begin with? Does that mean we should be destroying lands and encroaching into wild animals' homes to create more animal products? Of course not. I really don't like that defeatist attitude of like, well, the whole world's not going to do it. So what's the point? We might as well not ban wet markets. I mean, I'm sure you've seen these petitions. People are very much happy to ban wet markets. Well, do we say, well, people aren't going to stop eating animals, so why ban wet markets? Of course we don't. We go, wet markets are a big problem. But this is this Western philosophy, isn't it? Wet markets are objectively terrible and should be banned. Undeniably. But there is such a huge amount of absurdity to people in the West signing petitions going, ban wet markets because they can spread zoonotic disease. And no one says that's wrong. But then we go, well, hang on, ban pig and poultry farms because they can also spread disease. And you go, oh, well, the world's not going to be vegan, so why bother? But it's a very myopic view of the problem rather than the broader issue of the problem. There just is hypocrisy. And yes, again, absolutely, wet markets should be banned. But let's also not ignore the fact that it's not just about wet markets. They increase and exacerbate the risk, but so do all systems of animal exploitation in that sense. Another thing just to talk about when it comes to exploitation of animals, this is branching off now from the non-human animals we've talked about and looking more at humans and what's been happening there. It's interesting, isn't it? We talk about lockdown. We talk about the fact that these places are no longer, well, like cities are no longer operating as normal. So restaurants, cafes, and all non-essential places of business have been closed in so many areas around the world, here in London where I am, but in many, many, many areas now. A couple of places are still running just as normal. But farms and slaughterhouses, absolutely running just as normal. And I want to talk about this just for a moment because we know, I mean, farms are a bit different, but we know in slaughterhouses that there is a complete disregard for every life form that steps foot in there, particularly for the animals, but also when it comes to the humans in this environment. And this is, I thought this was quite interesting because to me, it just really highlights the absolute disrespect for all life, right, in this system. Basically, there's a few stories here. This one is Moy Park workers staged walkout over COVID-19 concerns. Moy Park, this is in Northern Ireland. They also have facilities in England. So in the UK, they're a poultry slaughterhouse. So basically, there was a mass walkout at this slaughterhouse place in Northern Ireland. The walkout occurred just days, this is the article, the walkout occurred just days after the company announced it was looking to fill hundreds of temporary jobs at its sites across Northern Ireland and Great Britain. Kirsty Wilkins, Moy Park Human Resources, what an absolute absurd role that she has. I mean, what an absolute offensive position to be in. Nothing more than lip service to the problem of human, of HR. Anyway, basically, they were worried about their health, as you would be. This is another part of the article. Around 80. Oh, this is a different place. Sorry, this is another place in the UK. Around 80 staff have walked out of ABP Meats. Again, related to fears about what's happening about COVID-19. Basically saying that, you know, this company, they have don't care about them. So both Moy Park and ABP don't care about them, don't care about getting ill. They're replaceable. You know, they're put in these highly, well, they're horrific environments for anyone to be in, of course. And they're being exploited for simple financial gain from these industries. This is one in the US, in Georgia. Police called to disperse Georgia meat processing workers who walked off the job Monday over concerns about the spread of COVID-19. So that these people again walked out demanding increased sanitary working conditions. Here it says several workers stated that the company has failed to provide a safe and sterile working environment and appears to have been lying in regard to nightly maintenance and cleaning. Fellow worker James Braswell pointed to the contradiction of management continuing to receive their bloated salaries working from home to avoid contracting and spreading COVID-19, while factory workers are compelled to risk their lives in an unsanitary workspace. Purdue Farms have been run by Purdue family for four generations and they're worth an estimated $3.2 billion. The company has faced intense criticism for its abusive practices towards labourers as well as animals. No surprises there, I mean, of course, all abusive. There was one thing I was reading, I'm trying to work out if it was in this article or not. It was basically saying that some of these slaughterhouse workers they go home, they show symptoms, they become ill, they self-isolate. The factory then replaces them, but they don't clean any of it down. And so then the workers come in and then they get ill because they're dealing with the same equipment that hasn't been cleaned. And the virus can live for 24 to 72 hours on hard surfaces, especially like metal surfaces that you'd find in a slaughterhouse. And then they get ill, they go home, they're replaced. And this mindset of just easily replacing these workers is just another example of how just, or when you view the industry in its totality, is the right way of saying that. It just shows how at every single step of the line, when you have animals being exploited, is just complete disregard for life in general. I just think it's absolutely shocking. And I think we talk about like, oh, it just seems silly to me that we're existing in a world where we're talking about everything being closed down. And yet even when society's halting, there's no respite for what's happening to the animals. And that these places don't stop and they're stockpiling this, so they're trying to produce food for people. That's the argument for it. But the absurdity of like having people who kill others labeled as essential key workers to me is really troubling. You know, the fact that we have these very easily, what they're deemed to be easily replaceable people who are basically going into these jobs, the companies knowing full well that they're going to get sick, sending them in there, getting sick, then replacing them with someone else who carries on killing animals, who then gets sick, and then replaced by someone else who does the same. It's just this constant rotation of killing and sickness because the industry doesn't care about anyone's life involved in that, and people don't mind as long as they can go into the supermarket and buy lots of meat and stockpile it for a pandemic that's been caused because we eat meat. And it's just again one of those things where you just go, hang on a second, can we just stop for a second and pause and think about what's going on? There's something else related to farming, and I found this to be quite interesting actually, not something I'd thought about. This is related to stockpiling. So obviously people have stockpiled a lot of food. That has a knock-on effect to fresh food producers. And one of the biggest producers of fresh food, when in terms of like food that is perishable very quickly, are dairy farmers. So this is an article. Wisconsin farmers forced to dump milk as coronavirus slams a fragile dairy economy. About 7 o'clock Tuesday night, Golden E Dairy got the call that any dairy farmer would dread. They were being asked to dump 25,000 gallons of fresh milk a day because there's no place for it to go, as the marketplace for dairy products has been gutted by the closure of restaurants, schools, hotels, and food service businesses. An hour later, the family-run farm, I love that. I mean, you can tell what angle they're taking with this. But anyway, you're supposed to feel sorry. I don't feel particularly sorry. An hour later, the family-run farm near West Bend opened the spigot, if that's how you pronounce it, and started flushing milk into a wastewater lagoon, 220,000 pounds a day. One of the things it's saying, the Wisconsin dairy industry has been dealt a harsh blow from the economy that's been slammed by coronavirus shutdowns. About one third of the state's dairy products, mostly cheese, are sold in the food service trade. Dairy farmers whose product is highly perishable are seeing processing plants, close or curb production, forcing them to flush their milk down the drain if there's no other buyer. I think that a lot of milk, this is this quote, will all of a sudden be dumped. Everyone across the industry is feeling distressed now. That's not a bad thing, is it? We'll take that. But it is interesting to think, actually, the knock-on effect that this will have, and there are maybe silver linings in this. Over the last several hours, says the quote, I've heard this is unfolding. There is definitely a strain on markets right now. The whole consumption rate for milk is so much different than it was before COVID-19. For now, Dairy Farmers of America, the cooperative that this particular family they're referencing belongs to, has agreed to pay them for their milk that's been dumped. But like most co-ops, DFA is in tough financial shape, and can only afford to do that for so long. I guess it opens up like the potential of, well, what does that mean for potentially farmers who are producing fresh produce? Now, it's not just dairy farmers, but dairy farmers in particular. What does that mean for these industries? And I suppose there is a very likely outcome that it'll force a lot of smaller farmers out of business if they're producing products that can't be sold because the food service is obviously stopped, and food service makes up such a massive portion of production. You've eliminated that, and you also have people who are more likely buying and stockpiling non-perishable foods. Often as non-perishable foods are, of course, plant-based, tinned and canned goods, as well as frozen goods, which of course could be meat-based as well. But in terms of like cupboard perishables, we're talking like rices and pastas and canned and tinned goods, which are normally not which are normally plant-based anyway. And so that does have a huge knock-on effect, just particularly to, I guess, like cheese and fresh milk, dairy farmers. So I don't know, maybe it'll be interesting to keep an eye on that and see if it does have a knock-on effect, see if there are any bailouts given to these industries, which of course we'd expect there probably will be for something like this. They are anyway, aren't they? But it'd be interesting to see what the knock-on effect is and whether it has a wider implication or causes a wider economic implication for farmers, particularly, of course, dairy farmers in general. So we'll see. We'll probably leave it there. I guess one thing, the podcasts will change. It's not going to be like this every week, but it is interesting to try and keep up to date with these things. And I just really want to talk about the prevalence of these viruses. I just can't believe it. I mean, you try it yourself, maybe go on Google and just type in like avian flu or swine flu, go on news, and go through and see what comes up. And see what it's been said, but I couldn't believe it. There was something about bird flu being found in a place in England, a different strain, so a less contagious strain. But still, again, these things can mutate at any point and become so much more severe than they are, which of course is what happened is now and has happened many times throughout the past and will of course happen again. But I couldn't believe it. I'd not thought about it. And swine flu, I'd not thought about this. And I guess the wider fear of coronaviruses, and I think this is probably what is going to happen now. I don't even know if it can be stopped now, is that this is very well going to be something that just exists now, right? I mean, like swine flu, the pandemic comes along and now swine flu just exists within society. It's not a huge risk to human life, but it exists nonetheless. And every life that is taken because of swine flu is a life that would not have been taken if we weren't exploiting animals in the first place. And you think about all these different diseases that we have built up within human society and how many of them probably wouldn't exist if we didn't do these things for animals. I mean, we wouldn't have had the swine flu pandemic if it wasn't for farming, right? Because that's how it originated and that's where it was found and that's how it kind of came to be. And so you think about COVID-19, well, there's a very real chance, I guess, now, because it's become such a huge pandemic affecting, a million people right now, with exponential growth still continuing, so goodness knows when it's going to stop. But is it just something that's going to exist now within human society? Of course, what people, the herd immunity is built up and things like that, so that, of course, it won't be such an issue, but it will exist, and people will still die of it into the future. And for what, you know? And I just think about swine flu. I just couldn't believe that when I read that. And I thought, of course, how did I not even realize this? I think somebody would think, well, it happens and it's gone. But it's not, you know, people in India are dying of swine flu. People in Scotland right now have swine flu as well as the COVID-19 outbreak happening. And whilst all these pandemics are occurring, we're finding strains of highly contagious bird flu and avian flu in farms across Europe that's spreading and has been found now for the past few months traveling across Europe. At any point could become dangerous. As well as bird flu found in the Philippines, in India. I mean, it's like sitting on a time bomb, I suppose. And one of the things that they said in this Vox Media piece that I watched, the 20-minute one I referenced earlier, is they said, you know, there's only three certainties in life. You know that saying, there's only two certainties in life, death and taxes. Well, this woman said there's actually three certainties in life, death, taxes, and pandemics. And I thought, wow, because it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And we'll never be able to eliminate the when, although if we look historically, most pandemics have been caused because of like influenza type viruses. We can never eliminate that when. You can significantly reduce the when by taking out the main contributor to that when, which is surely just the proliferation of animal exploitation. Anyway, let's leave it there for this week's podcast. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed it. I really do appreciate you tuning in. I hope you're all safe and well, and I hope that you enjoyed the latest Surge Media campaign that we put up last week. So just after I uploaded the last podcast, we did another video through Surge Media, like we did before about coronavirus, but really talking about antibiotic resistance. Well, this time we've done one about coronavirus, and also linking it to animal exploitation and zoonotic disease and animal exploitation. So if you haven't seen that yet, check it out. It's on my YouTube channel. Do check it out, and it's on my Instagram as well. So I hope you like that, and we've got a few more ideas for different content to produce over the coming weeks as well, but more about that as it happens. But yeah, thank you for listening to today's podcast. I really do appreciate it. I hope that you're all safe. I hope that you're looking after yourselves. Hopefully this is going to get easier soon, but I mean, it's just, at the moment, it's not, is it? It is increasing. I mean, I know that in certain places it's getting slightly better, but really it's not. Globally, it's getting worse all the time. You look at the US, for example, but even here in London, it's just, or the UK in general, just this is a difficult time, and I think it's going to get worse and worse before it's going to get better. I mean, it's pretty obvious that's going to happen, isn't it? So do stay safe. Do continue to stay safe, please. But yeah, okay. We'll leave it there then. Thank you for listening to today's podcast. I will talk to you guys next week. So I've got a special podcast coming up in the, which probably not next one, but the one after, which I'm looking forward to telling you guys about or uploading for you guys to listen to. But anyway, in the meantime, do stay safe. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Please use this time to spread information about veganism. Do what we can. We'll try and make something positive out of something that feels quite negative, doesn't it? All right, guys, thank you so much for listening to today's podcast. I really do appreciate it. And we will speak very shortly.
Thank you.